Thank you. Thanks. No. Sit it. No. Please. Thank you. Appreciate. You folks have good timing. Come to Washington in the right week. First of all, I apologize again for being late, and we'll obviously give you the full time here. I want to talk about a couple of issues, and then be happy to answer questions. First of all, this is a very important week for American agriculture here in Washington, D.C. It's important because simultaneously there will be discussions about the Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill in Congress, and at the same time there is work being done on the immigration bill. Let me talk specifically about the immigration bill first. This is, I think, a problem that needs to get resolved in this country, and it's a particular problem that needs to get resolved for agriculture. As I've traveled around the country, and I've been to, I think, 23 states since the first of the year, and one foreign trip, I have been impressed by how often the issue of workforce comes up in conversations with producers and producer groups. They are deeply concerned about having a consistent, stable workforce that is not worried about Homeland Security and ICE coming in and disrupting operations. So it's important and necessary that we get this done and we get it done right. I think that the Senate is working on a bill where agribusiness and labor got together, sat in a room, did what we want folks to do, which is to solve problems and come up with a consensus and collaboration and a comprehensive approach to agriculture. They've done that. The bill basically would create a pathway for citizenship for those who have been working in agriculture and who have been in this country for an extended period of time. It would offer them an incentive to stay in agriculture. We learned from the experience in the 80s that sometimes when we have immigration reform, it enables folks to move from one occupation to another, allowing agricultural workers to potentially have a faster track, if you will, to citizenship. Will provide them an incentive for them to stay in agriculture for a period of time. It complements that stable workforce with a guest worker system that is calibrated to be able to meet the worker needs of agribusiness and agriculture without creating an oversupply of labor that would potentially drive wages down and eliminate opportunities for Americans, or provide for too few workers that would make it difficult for producers to either find workforce or to be able to afford that workforce. It also allows for adjustments of those numbers of guest workers on a process and a system that allows for and is dependent on producer input, which is important, and it allows for wage levels to be calibrated up or down within a certain range so that agriculture is never confronted with huge spikes in wage increases, nor are workers faced with significant declines in wages from year to year. So it creates real stability and consistency, which I think any business, and particularly agriculture, wants and needs. So I'm sincerely hopeful that the efforts to derail immigration reform are not successful, and that we get a bill through the Senate and through the House and to the President's desk at some point in time this year. And I think that there are a lot of farm groups, agribusinesses, and unions that are feeling the same way. The second issue, obviously, is getting a five-year bill through the process. As you all know, I refer to it as the Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill. You all refer to it as the Farm Bill. An interesting statistic that I read recently, I think it was from an ERS study, suggested that 32,000 farm families are responsible for 50% of the agricultural production in this country. I mean, we have been extraordinarily efficient and effective in agriculture. The consequence of that, however, is that we no longer have a situation where one farm supports multiple families. It's now multiple farms supporting a single family. And the reality is that we did not supplement or complement that great efficiency in agriculture with what's next. so that young people in particular had the opportunity to stay in rural communities and continue to contribute to rural communities. So this five-year program really is the roadmap, if you will, for revitalizing the rural economy and rebuilding the rural economy so that we begin to complement production agriculture and offer other alternatives for young people as we continue to become efficient and effective in agricultural production. So it's essential that we get this done and we get it, again, done right. Obviously, we need a safety net, and I think the Senate is certainly listened to the concerns expressed by the House and expressed by some of the southern producers and has tried to moderate or calibrate its safety net proposal in addition to crop insurance to sort of address some of the concerns that southern producers had. So I think it's a good indication of the Senate's willingness to work through these issues. Clearly, a commitment to crop insurance is inherent in both proposals. An understanding of the importance of research, I think, is inherent in both proposals. The importance of trade and the importance of promoting trade, again, in both House and Senate proposals. An understanding of, in the Senate in particular, the need for a significant commitment to the bio-based energy and bio-based product production opportunities that I think are emerging as one way to complement production agriculture and create opportunities in rural areas. The Senate has made a significant commitment in that respect in their proposal, and I think I'm hopeful that the House will see the wisdom of that approach. Obviously, conservation, again, critically important. I certainly appreciate the fact that both the Senate and the House understand the need to streamline our processes a bit to make it less cumbersome and less silo-oriented and provide some flexibility while saving some money for taxpayers. Obviously, there's going to be a dispute on the nutrition issue. And I think it's important for producers to understand that 16 cents of every one of those food dollars ends up in their pocket. So it is, in my view anyway, part of the overall safety net for producers. And it's also a way of garnering the support from folks who do not have rural constituencies in their congressional district where rural constituents are not a significant component, if you will, of an overall state population. It's important, I think, and necessary to continue to reach out to those folks who are representing primarily urban and suburban voters and explain to them that there is something in this bill for them in order to get the votes to get it through the process. That's obviously going to be a difficult issue, but we'll work through it, I'm sure. The key here is getting a bill done, getting it done before September 30th, getting it done in a way that allows us to continue the momentum that's been built in the rural economy and to continue to be able to send the message to young people in particular that there's opportunities in agriculture at every level and that there are opportunities to complement agricultural production through conservation, outdoor recreation, local and regional food systems, which are, again, strongly supported in the House or in the Senate proposal and I think recognized as an important component in the House proposal as well. So, you know, I just think that this is a good time. And it's frankly a time when what's needed in Washington is the ability of Washington to work. And I think in both immigration and in the five-year farm program, we have two great opportunities to send a message to people across the country that Democrats and Republicans, Senate members and House members can work together to solve problems and get things done. So this would be two very positive messages of cooperation and collaboration and compromise. And I hope we don't miss either opportunity because agriculture needs both and rural communities need both and the country needs both. The last thing I'll touch on very briefly is you know, we've got a funky climate out there. you know, I was in Idaho yesterday, and it was 95 degrees, you know, Boise, Idaho. You know, I think we have to recognize that we're going to have more variability in weather. We're going to have greater intensity in storms and floods and droughts than we've experienced, and that we have got to look at this from a long-term perspective of what needs to be done to mitigate and or adapt our private working lands and our forested areas to this variability in the climate, or we will risk losing our productive edge, our productivity edge. That's why we've doubled the amount of research money that we've allocated to developing strategies for adaptation and mitigation of climate. It's why we're working on reducing barriers to multi-cropping and cover cropping, which can help us conserve water resources. It's why we are investing in more efficient water management systems and trying to figure out best practices, and why we'll be making additional announcements, if you will, in terms of what we're doing relative to climate in the next month or two, and see this as one of the long-term commitments that USDA's got to make in order to put agriculture in the best possible position to deal with the variability that we're seeing and that we're going to continue to see and see more of. You know, we have the greatest producers in the world, but they have been challenged by Mother Nature, and we need to be up to that challenge. So let me stop there and open it up to questions.
And question again, state your affiliation so our secretary knows your area of the country. Jeff?
Jeff Galley with Carmel Ag Radio Network. Thanks for spending time with us today. With regard to the plans that are being offered in both the House and the Senate, it seems as though, Mr. Secretary, there's something for everybody. There's a revenue plan, there's a target plan, there's a plan for every crop. They look to be long on ideas and short on money. Can these plans adequately protect our producers with the risk that they need covered in the months ahead?
Well, I think so. I think so, Jeff. I really do. I think that obviously both the House and the Senate understand that we have to continue to be part of solving the fiscal challenges that the country faces, which is why both plans provide for reduced spending overall. They get it there in slightly different ways, but you know, at the end of the day, the differences that there exist will no doubt be worked out. To me, the critical challenge of putting together a 5-year bill is actually dealing with those regional differences in agriculture and making sure that everyone, as you say, sees a little something that they like about what's being proposed. And I think that we're closer today in that respect than we were 3 or 4 months ago, because I think the Senate understands, you know, target prices have to be part of this, and I think the fact that we have a different ranking member on the Senate Ag Committee makes a difference. And I think, frankly, there's a lot of pressure on both of the House and the Senate to get this done. I think there's a lot of disappointment that it didn't get done last year. I'm pleased with the fact that the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader in the House have publicly stated that this is a priority for them to get done. And certainly the Majority Leader of the Senate has been there all along because they got it passed last year. And I think they're on a pretty fast track to try to get this thing done this summer. So I'm optimistic. I'm going to continue to be optimistic. It's not going to be easy. The differences are significant on nutrition. The differences are a bit significant on precisely how you structure that safety net. But I think on balance, it's going to be there. It's going to be sufficient and adequate enough and significant enough that most commodity groups are going to say, this is okay. We can live with this. You know, I think dairy is going to be a challenge. I think everybody likes the price support, price stabilization piece of it. It's the how do you ensure that it doesn't break the bank financially. Both CBO scores currently have it, I think, based on the supply side piece of that, the supply management side. And I think there are some folks who don't like that aspect of the dairy program. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens during the committee process to that, and during the floor action to that, and how that changes the equation, if you will, for votes. But clearly something's got to get done in dairy. because we've had too much volatility and we've lost too many of our producers because of it. And I think Colin Peterson and others have made a good faith effort to try to deal with that stability issue, and I think they've also been sensitive to the fact that you just can't open the bank. You got to have some kind of mechanism that limits or creates some reaction to oversupply, which today we don't really have.
Do they look like bills you could defend?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think I can. I mean, I clearly the Senate bill is clearly one that I could go out and. I mean, I you know, as I talk about the restructuring of this rural economy, I think it's a commitment to production agriculture through crop insurance, through research, and through and through the various revenue protection programs. I think the conservation piece of this, you know, streamlining it, continuing to support EQIP, CSP, CRP, recognizing that there may not be as much money as anybody would like, but our response to that is fine, we get it, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily have to admit that there's going to be less money overall in conservation. And I'll share with you what we're going to do here, I hope. I'll explain to you why this is complicated. There's a fellow who's a friend of mine, who was a major player in a Fortune 100 company, maybe a Fortune 50 company, big company, who has done really well in life and is at that point in life where he wants to give something back. He wants to work at USDA, doesn't want to get paid, which is you'd think you could say, well, great, some guy doesn't want to get paid, you know, give him an office, give him a phone, let him go to work. It's more complicated than that because of the ethics requirements. But we're working through those, and his job is going to be to look for ways to create partnerships that don't exist today or that can be extended to bring additional resources into the rural economy. So, for example, it may be that there's a corporation or entity that has as a corporate responsibility requirement to focus on water quality. And you could then link them up with potential conservation opportunities or an ecosystem market that would bring private sector money into the economy. Or it may be that there's a community in a small town that wants to create a new water treatment operation, but boy, they're just having a hard time figuring out precisely where the money's going to come from. They can't get the local banker to buy into a multi-million-dollar operation. But, you know, some major corporation who would get a bit of a small return on their money, but yet nevertheless a return on their money, might be willing to contribute or invest in that project just because they got a social responsibility requirement that would be met by investing in a project like that. So his job is going to be to try to figure out ways in which we can attract more resource so that we complement and leverage federal resources. You know, the government has been in the position of giving money, granting money, loaning money, guaranteeing loans. Now I think we're going to create a fourth responsibility here at USDA, which is to facilitate and bridge private sector investment, nonprofit sector investment to rural projects. And so I think there are there's a lot to like about what the Senate's working on. In particular, in my view, they've provided money for the bio-based economy and bioenergy, which I think is really important. They understand the need for us to be able to have additional tools to attract research dollars into agriculture. They continue to support trade. They understand the importance of specialty crops, organic and value-added opportunities for the local and regional food system. So I think there's a lot there that you can go out and explain to everybody in the country. This is a bill for everybody. It's not just for farmers. It's not just for folks in rural communities. It's a bill for everybody.
Ron? Mr. Secretary Ron Hayes out of Oklahoma City Radio, Oklahoma Network. I wanted to change gears just a little bit. Another pressing issue for you is to deal with the COOL issue and the deadline later this month to get a plan that the WTO can deal with and the Canadians, Mexicans can deal with. How exactly do you see this thing playing out? Obviously, we're trying to find something that will work with the Canadians and the Mexicans. They're important customers of ours. We want to try to satisfy them at the same time. I know you want to protect the cool rule as best you can.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I've got a statutory directive from Congress, which I have to comply with, and I have to follow the law, and we intend to do that. We intend to meet the May 23rd deadline, as we're required to do. I have had conversations with the Canadian minister. I'm traveling to Mexico on Thursday to talk to the new Mexican minister, Minister Martinez. We're going to put forward what we believe complies with the letter and the spirit of the WTO ruling. Again, they did not question our capacity to label. They questioned the process by which we labeled, the process itself. We think we've improved on that process, and we're going to move forward on May 23rd with that approach. The Mexicans and Canadians will then have a decision to make. And if they're not satisfied with what we've proposed and what we've put forward, they have certain avenues they can travel down. The WTO would then have to make additional decisions, and whatever those decisions are, we will obviously follow them. But we think we believe we will propose on May 23rd a rule that follows the congressional directive, which we're required to do, and complies with the WTO decision, which we're also required to do.
How long do you anticipate giving the industry time to put everything in place before you actually implement it?
Well, I want to be really careful about how I answer this question, because words matter in this context. And so let me just simply say, from our perspective, implementation occurs when the rule is filed and submitted on May 23rd, recognizing that there will be a period of time that we've had in the past and will have here, in which the steps that industry must take and will need to take to comply, they will take. I'd rather not discuss a defined amount of time, because I think that would not be appropriate, given the fact that we haven't yet, finished the process. But I would say that, history is a good lesson in terms of the amount of time that we've provided in the past.
There will be a ramp-up period.
Well, I think I'll just stick with the answer I just gave you. And I'm not trying to be cute about this. This is a very technical set of issues, and it could be misconstrued or misinterpreted if I use the wrong terminology, and I don't want to do that. And I don't want to, what I'm saying is, on May 23rd, we're going to have the rule, and in the past, we've provided a process, and we'll provide a process, but I don't want to pin myself down to a particular timeline, because I think that would be inappropriate at this point.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Secretary, Chuck Zimmerman, AgWire.com. Could you make a comment about the APHIS decision on conducting additional, regulatory review on the 2,4-D and dicamba tolerant traits, and what that might mean to farmers?
Well, an extremely, it's a novel and new product. And our folks looked at this and felt that it would be necessary and appropriate to do a more in-depth review of the impact of this, as is required under NEPA. We have two responsibilities in this regulatory situation. We have the responsibility to apply the Pest Protection Act, but we also have a responsibility to provide to comply with NEPA requirements. And we felt with the novelty and the newness of these particular potential crops that it would be appropriate and necessary, and would allow us to have the strongest possible set of decisions, both from a regulatory standpoint and from a legal standpoint. And that's what, that's the decision that you have to make. I did visit with both officials at Dow and Monsanto to let them know this is what we're doing, and we felt that we had appropriate legal and statutory responsibilities that would be complied by an EIS. We'll do it in a timely way, and we think it's the best approach.
Mr. Secretary, Susan Littlefield from KZEN in Columbus, Nebraska. At a producer that texted me this morning wanted your thoughts, even though it's in the hands of the president, of the Keystone XL pipeline and all the environmental issues that came about with it.
Look, I'm got a hard enough time running this department. I'm not going to run the energy department or the State Department. I will say this. My focus on energy is on opportunities that create that complement to production agriculture that will give us alternatives for our young people to want to stay, live, raise their families, and contribute to their communities in rural areas. I am obviously a strong proponent of taking every aspect of agricultural production and maximizing its return by creating chemicals, fuels, energy, fabrics, fibers out of everything that we can produce agriculturally and using our land as efficiently and as effectively as possible. And I think there's still a lot more we can do, which is why we're focused on multi-cropping and cover cropping. I think in response to Jeff's question, I think that the Senate bill, which provides for significant mandatory funding to support this effort, is really important for the future of rural America and, frankly, to give an additional alternative market opportunities for producers. That's my focus, and I think that's what the Secretary of Agriculture's focus ought to be. And how that fits into the overall energy strategy for the country, I think the President has been very clear about all of the above, and I think he's got the right strategy. I mean, it's pretty apparent we're becoming less reliant on foreign oil. It's pretty apparent that that's helping to improve the economic conditions in this country, and it's, I think, also suggests that in the long term, America is going to be quite competitive because we've got all the above strategy. And I think we're just, I think we're on the cusp of a new real opportunity in rural areas. So that's where my focus is.
Yes,
Mr. Secretary, Deanna Thomas from WMBD in Peoria. Can you just talk a little bit about the progress being made on WERDA? There's a lot of legislation out there, and we were here a couple of months ago, and progress is being made in the need for that improved infrastructure on the waterways, in particular the Illinois and Mississippi rivers.
Well, it depends, obviously, on funding. I've suggested and provided folks in a number of agencies and departments with an idea and a concept that that would allow our lock and dam systems to be improved and figure out strategies and ways in which we could encourage private sector investment. Some folks have proposed an infrastructure bank. There's a water bill pending in Congress that potentially could be of some benefit. And I think how you characterize improvements and how you can encourage potential utility companies to work with the lock and dam systems to create potential hydro opportunities could create another vehicle for funding those improvement projects. So I think the key here is finding the money. And recognizing that we've got we need to upgrade all of our transportation systems in this country in order to be competitive with those countries that are emerging and who have not had to invest in legacy transportation systems but have sort of leapfrogged some of the older ways of doing business and are now in a position where potentially they could have a competitive edge because they can get product to market faster and quicker and less expensively, and it's about port improvements. It's about locks and dams. It's about rails. It's about air transportation. So, I mean, it's about all of it. But it does require a commitment of resources, and it has to. I think that's why the president has been so insistent that as we deal with deficit reduction, we do it in a balanced way, that you can't cut your way totally to deficit reduction. You also have to grow your way out of a deficit. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that our deficit is coming down, in part because of the cuts, but also in part because our economy is picking up a little bit. And as it picks up, that deficit becomes less and less. Investing in infrastructure puts people to work. It creates a more competitive America. Long term, it's in the best interest of everybody for us to find the resources to invest in those capital projects. And I hope Congress does that.
Todd Gleason, University of Illinois Extension. Ultimately, I'm your employee, I suppose.
Well, I suppose you're my employee. I'm your employee, too, because you're part of the citizenry of the United States.
Twice in the last, in our conversation, you mentioned private sector dollars and reaching out for private sector dollars. We know in the university system, those always come with restrictions. It's unique that the government at the federal level would be looking to draw private sector dollars in. What are the potential pitfalls that you see with doing that type of product?
Well, I think it's a little bit different than a university system. I'm not really familiar with what happens at universities other than oftentimes there are research projects that are funded by the private sector, and that helps to fund labs and that type of thing. What we're talking about here, And what I learned when I visited some investment banker folks in New York City a couple weeks ago, they're not aware of the projects. It's not a situation where they've made a conscious decision not to put money into rural America. They just simply aren't aware. So one thing that we can do is make them aware of opportunities, which is what I hope this person I'm bringing into the USDA will do, is he will go out and he will market projects that might be of interest to the private sector as an investment. I mean, if you got a utility or water municipal water utility company that wants to upgrade their water treatment facility, and they basically have ratepayers and they have a revenue stream and they can, you know, guarantee a return on investment of X percent, there may very well be folks out there that are very interested in that stable, secure, less risky investment. They just don't know about these projects. And we have quite a waiting list of them. So I don't see this as the private sector imposing any restrictions on us. You know, we have the ability to say, well, you know, we can't do that. And it's maybe a university is more in need of those resources in a sense. We have the capacity to say no, thank you. But I think what will happen is people will say, well, shoot, I didn't know there were these kind of projects out there, and you know that's something we'd like to invest in. Or in meeting with some of the CEOs of companies that I meet with, we say, you know, what is your social responsibility platform, and are you investing in rural areas? And then they say, well, you know, tell us more about how we could do that. And there are opportunities in the forest. There are opportunities in private conservation with ecosystem market investments. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of creative ways. I budget cuts and reduced budgets are hard. And I'm really proud of what we've done here at USDA. We've identified $828 million of savings. Reduced our workforce. We've closed offices. We're condensing rental space. We're you know, looking at our vehicles differently, not turning them over as frequently. We're consolidating our supply purchases. We're streamlining our IT systems. And we've identified $828 million, which means that we won't likely have to furlough anybody here, which means we won't likely have to disrupt the services to the people out there in rural America that count on us to be on the job 5 days a week, you know, eight hours a day kind of thing. So I don't see this as having problems or restrictions. I see this as, okay, there's a demand and need out there. you have a finite amount of money that's going to be made available to you by Congress. How do you complement and supplement that? And how do you unleash the creativity here? You know, the other thing is it's simpler, obviously, to grant money. It's simpler to have the banker do all the legwork and you come in with a guarantee. But now what we're saying to our folks is be creative. Think about how you might be able to facilitate somebody who's got money and somebody who's got a project. Even if you don't have the money, but you know about the project and you know about the person with money, see if you can marry the two. That's just as good as you making a grant or guaranteeing a loan or making a loan because you get the project done. And I think if we can do more of that, then we can still get investments in rural communities, still live within our means, and still have purpose here at USDA. And I think, frankly, folks working here are going to be excited about the ability to be proactive. Bill's over here. He's the ecosystem market guy. Is your work a little more interesting because you got the possibility of putting together ecosystem markets? And
I don't think my work would get any more interesting.
So, Bill Holmes is a good example of what I'm talking about. We've basically said to Bill, look, figure something out here, and he's working on creating measurements and verification systems for conservation benefits on the theory that once you're able to measure and verify a conservation benefit, you'll be able to market and sell it to somebody.
One more question before we do.
Got a little bit more.
On behalf of all the broadcasters, and you kind of touched on your staff here, we thank you for a great staff of communicators and your media people that make our job easier and make our jobs more effective in trying to help you spread the word in rural America, Mr. Secretary. So if you would please thank your staff, some of them that are here, but they're very important to us, and they do a great, great job for you and for American agriculture.
Well, I appreciate that. They'll have to accept that because there's no pay increase and hasn't been for the last 3 years. But
right. One more question. Mike Herbert had his hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Well, I take two more. I'll take one. With this one and one more.
Red River Farm Network in Grand Forks. We'd love to have you come back in Fargo this September. But there's efforts here, I understand, to trim who can qualify for crop insurance premiums through such things as means testing. Also, the other push that our people are particularly concerned about is tying conservation compliance to crop insurance. Your thoughts on either one of those?
Well, we support the idea of compliance and conservation compliance, and here's why. Look, it's a bargain. It's a deal that's made between taxpayers, farmers, and insurance companies. And the deal is we recognize Mother Nature can be unpredictable. We want to support our farmers. We want to provide them risk management tools. And we're happy to provide some of the resources to make that possible. In many cases, we're paying as taxpayers 50, 55, 60, 62, 63% of the premium. In the past, we also provided a direct payment. And as part of the direct payment deal, we said, look, in exchange for this check that you're going to get, regardless of whether you had a good year or a bad year, we're going to expect something in return. Not a whole lot, but we're going to expect something in return. And what we're going to expect in return is conservation compliance. Well, if you do away with direct payments, which it seems pretty obvious that's going to happen, the question is then, what do you do about conservation compliance? Well, what did we do before we had direct payments? Well, interestingly enough, what we did before is we said, if you're going to get the benefit of a premium subsidy that's pretty significant, 55, 60, 62, 63%, we'd ask you to put together a plan and be compliant with that plan. And we would suggest that we gauge compliance by a date certain before the crop year so we don't get in a position where we're giving you a subsidy and then having to take it back because things didn't work out. So some predictability and consistency in the system. And I don't think that that's too much to ask. And I think if you went out on the street and asked the man on the street or the woman on the street, do you think this is a fair deal that the government will pay 50, 55, 60, 62% of a premium to protect a crop from disaster? And in exchange for that, we want to work with you to make sure the conservation is part of your thought process. I think that's a pretty good deal. I think it's a fair deal. So I think you would find among the general public and taxpayers, particularly in this time when we're reducing budgets and asking people to do with less, it seems like a fair deal. What we've proposed in the budget is, I think, also recognizing that that when the taxpayers are paying more than 50% of the premium, maybe that's especially when we're reducing so many other areas of government spending, maybe it's not unfair to ask for just a little bit more from producers, and that's why we've proposed in the budget. That's all going to get worked out. At the end of the day, we're going to have a strong crop insurance program. And that's, at the end of the day, that's really what it's all about. We're going to have a strong, viable, financially solvent and stable crop insurance program, and it's obviously it works. And the proof of that is 2012. We didn't have a hue and a cry from the countryside because folks, despite the fact that we had a terrible drought, folks were able to, the crop folks were able to get by. Now my hope is that we get a five-year bill that includes disaster assistance so that we retroactively can help our livestock and dairy producers that went through a tough time. It's a shame that they didn't get the help in 2012 when they needed it. It's a shame that we didn't fully fund those disaster programs through the 2008 Farm Bill. And it's a shame we didn't extend them in 2011 when they expired. And it's a shame we didn't extend them in 2012 when they extended some but not all of the 2008 farm programs. But they got a chance to rectify that by quickly acting on this five-year bill and including a disaster assistance program. So, I think it's a fair deal. One more.
Go ahead.
Brian Winnikins from WRDN in Durand, Wisconsin. You mentioned, we're right along the Mississippi River, you mentioned about the WRDA program for the funding. It was always my understanding that the barge operators had been paying something into a fund for lock and dam, either maintenance and or upgrades. Whatever happened with that, or my misunderstanding?
I'm not sure about that, but I would say this. It's a very expensive proposition, and regardless of what they were paying, it's probably not enough to do what needs to be done. I mean, we're talking about a system that's 50, 60 years old, and improvements on it are long overdue. And now we're faced with a situation where resources are constrained. Again, I would go back to my earlier comment, which is that this is about growing your way out of a deficit. It's about creating a competitive American economy, and it's about putting people to work. And honestly, I don't know why we can't get 60 votes in the Senate and 218 votes in the House to do that. Because it will pay. Part of the problem is that sometimes we look at investments made by government and we don't calculate the return on investment. We say, well, this is going to add to the deficit. Well, maybe it won't add to the deficit. Maybe it'll reduce the deficit. You spend money, you improve the system, you put people to work, they pay taxes, you create a more effective and competitive American economy. That puts more people to work or keeps people employed. They pay taxes, and over the period of the life of that investment, you more than get your money back. So I think we have to think a little differently about infrastructure investments. It's unfortunate we don't have what many states have, which is a capital budget. That, the way this works here in Washington, you have to fund a project in a single year. And in the state budgets, they have a capital account, and they are able to invest in infrastructure through a separate funding mechanism. It's too bad we don't have that. And I think that's what an infrastructure bank and some of the concepts and ideas behind infrastructure bank, that's really what that's designed to do, is to create some kind of mechanism where you are able to put resources to work to meet your capital needs so that they're not always competing with your day-to-day needs. I mean, I'll give you a good example. We have 100 ARS labs, and we've done a capital evaluation of all those labs. We've looked at what kind of physical shape are they in, what kind of research is being done, and is it a high-priority research, low-priority research, in good shape, not in very good shape facility. And then given the amount of money that we have available to us, maybe some of those labs that are not in very good condition or doing low priority work, maybe they need to be closed. But now we've identified, for example, in this year's budget, we've identified the need for a new poultry lab. It's $155 million. Now, in the past, what you'd do is you'd do $10 million here and $20 million here, and over the course of 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, you'd eventually accumulate that money to be able to buy it. But the problem with that is that money's sitting out there, and so if Congress has a problem that they got to address immediately and they're looking for something to offset that, they just take that money and you got to start over again. So what we've done this year is we said, look, here's the deal. We're going to bite the bullet here. We have identified $155 million in our budget. And instead of sprinkling that out among 14 different projects, we propose building a new poultry lab. And the reason we do is because we've learned a lot about poultry in the last 30, 40 years, and our labs need to be upgraded so we can deal with these more exotic diseases and problems that are occurring around the world, so we can, our poultry industry can continue to be strong and continue to be the best in the world. That's really hard to do when you're taking that $155 million at the same time you're trying to figure out, how do I provide loans for FSA, or how do I fund that water project that everybody wants, or how do I create that bio-based business opportunity. It's hard. So I suspect that's what we can get you more information about the barge issues specifically, but I think that's sort of the challenges that you face.
Mr. Secretary, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks.
Thank you.